Okay, then listen. Let's not get caught.
What are you talking about?
Let's keep going.
What do you mean?
Go!
You probably already know who you're listening to there, Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis. And you probably know the film too, Thelma and Louise getting ready to gun the engine and drive their Thunderbird convertible over a cliff and into the Grand Canyon. It's one of the most recognized movies in America. It's the story of two women running away from the law and from their own lives. It was a movie that had trouble getting made and then, following its release in 1991, became a huge hit.
I think the movie had such a profound effect on people because they were seeing real women, and these women were coping with the kinds of issues that so frustrate women in normal life.
That's author Becky Aikman there. She says Thelma and Louise was a rare, almost unheard of film, fantasy and escapism based on the ordinary lives of two ordinary women. Making the film was improbable too. A young female novice screenwriter and two women in the lead roles. Aikman has a new book. It's called Off the Cliff: How the Making of Thelma and Louise Drove Hollywood to the Edge. The screenwriter was Callie Curry, and Aikman says Curry envisioned a film that was ultimately about women escaping the bounds of society. That final classic scene, the convertible flying over the cliff, it wasn't about death. It was about flight.
That's how Callie saw that ending. She didn't see it as depressing. She saw it as a break for freedom.
And talking about that ending, by the way, she said they had to leave at the end of the film, right? It wasn't a death, she said. It wasn't a suicide. I think she said it was flight. It was freedom.
Yes, that's how she saw it. And the director, Ridley Scott, saw it as Thelma and Louise entering into the realm of myth. It's why he set that scene in such a grand, majestic setting so that it would have that sense for the audience.
Well, let's talk about Callie Curry for a minute, because this was an improbable film. She was an improbable screenwriter in the sense that she'd never done one before, and she was kind of working on some pretty seedy fringes of the film industry at the time.
That's true. It's such a lesson about how an outlier can come in and make a very original statement. Callie was 30 years old when she wrote this. She was a college dropout and former waitress, and her job at that time was working behind the scenes on really cheesy music videos. She was working in a very sexist industry, Hollywood, but at the lowest possible end of it, where she had to help hire strippers to dance in the background of music videos from second-rate bands.
We're talking like Whitesnake and, sorry, Whitesnake fans, but we're talking like rock videos and...
Right, yes. A lot of videos of guys in spandex with big hair and women shaking their booty.
And somehow she comes to the place where she's putting together this story that becomes Thelma and Louise on her own or late at night.
That's right. And Thelma and Louise are the characters are based on Callie and her close friend, Pam Tillis. One of them is the more flighty one of them is the more sensible one, but they often switch roles, as the two characters do in the movie.
Well, you mentioned Ridley Scott, who is another improbable part of this film. He was reluctant at first to get involved. He was already a legend. People hear Ridley Scott and they think, of course, Alien. They think Blade Runner. That's the Ridley Scott that we all know. We're not thinking of renegade women pushing back and freeing themselves from authority necessarily. He didn't want to be involved in this thing when he first read it.
That's for sure. When he first read it, Ridley was also somewhat of an outlier. He worked mostly in England, and he wasn't that aware that women's films were considered box office cyanide by Hollywood. He read the script and he thought it was wonderfully written. And first he wanted to produce. As he shopped it around to various other directors who didn't see it the way he did, he became convinced that he should direct. And that's another key moment when things went right that could have gone wrong, because Ridley recognized what he didn't know. He realized he didn't understand this women's film. He didn't understand these characters. So he spent a lot of time with Callie Curry going through the script and subsuming his point of view to hers. For example, she explained to him that women really do have to listen to catcalls from people like the truck driver. Ridley expressed skepticism to me that that really happened, but he decided if this is the way Callie wrote it, this is the way he's filming it. So he wound up making a picture from a woman's point of view, even though, as you say from his other films, it's not the kind of thing he usually does.
What was different about this project getting done that's different from thousands of other movies that get made and churned and make money or don't and on to the next?
Right. Well, as we know today, and it was the same back then, Hollywood was very reluctant to make movies that were directed by women, written by women, that had women as the leading characters. When this script was shopped around Hollywood, people were very open about saying, we can't make this, there are two women in the leads. Callie Curry was told by many people that the script was great, but that she needed to tone it down. The women weren't likable. The audience wouldn't stand for it if women committed violence. She was told that she should have a man rescue them at the end. When the script was sent out for studios to bid on, they all said no, except for one, a very small, financially troubled studio called Pathé Entertainment. It was the only one willing to take a risk on a movie like this.
Talk about taking risks. We talked a moment ago in our movie segment about a little bit of trivia for this movie that Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon did not have the first look at this script. In fact, it was Jodie Foster and Michelle Pfeiffer. How is it that they did not wind up being in this blockbuster hit?
There were so many delays while Ridley was trying to line up a studio willing to pay for it, while he was trying to find a director. They had to move on to other projects. And at that point, every female actress in Hollywood wanted one of these two roles, because a role like this is so hard to come by. So virtually any name from that era was considered for the parts. When Ridley Scott chose Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon, he did it over the studio's objections, because they wanted bigger box office stars. They liked the idea of Cher. They liked the idea of Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn. But Ridley doesn't care about big name stars. He wanted the people he saw as being right for the part.
Why was it such a hit? What did it do for people that they hadn't seen before or that really got inside of them, do you think?
It came straight from the heart of Callie Curry. It was completely from a woman's point of view. The action in the movie arises from all the kinds of things that drive women crazy in their real lives. And women got to see somebody rebel against that, got to see themselves on the screen. That is very rare. As the marketing department for Thelma and Louise was always worried, they said, we know we could possibly sell a woman's movie, but the woman has to be bimbo-ish. That's the only way we know how to sell it. So that's what most of us are accustomed to seeing on screen. People went crazy because they saw somebody they thought seemed real.
I mean, it's the movies. You can't go around blowing up trucks when people make you mad. You can't go around shooting people. But they did in this movie, and you write, and I think you're quoting Callie Curry here, you can write a true story that never happened.
Right. Of course, it's bigger than life. Of course, when some guy makes a catcall to me on the street, I would like to blow up his truck. But I don't. It's a lot of fun to see it on the screen, though. There's a truth at the center of it.
The book is Off the Cliff, How the Making of Thelma and Louise Drove Hollywood to the Edge. Becky Aikman is the author. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
What's your most memorable road trip?
Hi, I'm Vicky from the San Francisco Bay Area. The man who became my second husband flew to Miami, where I lived, to travel with me cross country to join him in San Francisco, where I had a job waiting. We were flying down the road in the middle of Texas when I got pulled over by a highway patrolman. "Ma'am, what clock did you want? 85, he said. "Do you have any guns or contraband?" We didn't, but we did have open containers of margaritas, and the car reeked of tequila. I think we dodged a big bullet on that. I was 29. That was my first speeding ticket, and it was payable to Judge Freddie Capers. The marriage didn't last, but we sure had fun on that trip.
Hi, this is Megan from Denton, Texas. Just wanted to share a little road trip I took a few years ago with just myself and my little dog, Twig. We left Denton and drove a week through New Mexico, hitting up their state parks. We saw volcanoes in Capulin and slept in my car in Eagle's Nest Lake and went camping and swimming at Elephant Butte State Park and ate SpaghettiOs from a can watching the sunset at White Sands National Monument. I don't have him anymore. He died earlier this year, so it's kind of my greatest memory I could ever have.
One road trip with the dog, another with the ex. Tell us your road trip stories, good or bad, 8778-MY-TAKE. You can join the conversation on our Facebook page.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.